What is the void? What is emptiness? What is the void? Where does it reside? Is the void dark matter? Is it a concept that's only in science, in Western thought? Well, not really, because in the East, there's the concept of shunyata, which comes from the word shunya in Sanskrit, which means zero. The number zero was given to us from the East, from India. So the topic of discussion for tonight will be voidism, but not voidism as a religious thought, but not limited only as a mere philosophy, but as a set of concepts and something to explore. So I hope you enjoy it. All right, what's going on, everybody? It's been a while. Bar set at midnight. I know I've taken a little hiatus, but I want to get back into content creating because I miss you guys. I miss doing this. But it's been a really good break. But anyway, I have one of my favorite people on earth here with me, man. This is Hunter Salazar. And please check out his YouTube channel because I would say, man, that your channel has the most unique spiritual content, in my opinion, on there, man. Really, really unique stuff.
Nice. Thank you.
Yeah, no problem, man. So, Hunter Salazar on YouTube, and welcome back. And tonight, we're going to talk about the void and voidism. And the reason I wanted to do this is because I remember some years ago, I can't remember how many now, because I've been watching you for a while. You had a couple of videos where you were talking about voidism, and I remember my first impression was this was like a sort of like a I don't want to say a grassroots philosophy or something perennial, but I don't know. It felt like to me back then like you were taking an old idea and reinterpreting it for like a neo-Western audience, like for now, you know what I mean? So something that we can understand and kind of run with and get our own experiences out of. And I remember one of your videos, you said something about sharing ideas, like that's what this is. We share information, share ideas. And that made me think of Hinduism, but it also didn't at the same time. So I don't know. So like, I don't want to spoil it for anybody. If you haven't seen that video, I don't know how long ago you did that. That was probably.
I have like dozens of, well, at least a dozen videos on voidism, probably more like 18 to 24, but it can be. So I guess, should we start with the philosophy side or should we start with the magic side of it? Or
I kind of want to get to the philosophy side because like that, you know, like what, so from your point of view, I know everybody that listening has their own ideas to what that is, but what is voidism exactly from you? Like, how did you discover it? How did you sort of make sense of it? Like, what is it to you?
I kind of discovered it just by thinking, to be honest.
Okay.
For a long time, I wrote pages and pages of philosophy, just trying to figure everything out, just in my own little, like, mental bubble of what I knew in my head. So voidism as a philosophy, to me, it doesn't exist necessarily as an English word. Like we discussed before, I I came up with my own concept of it just based on a very vague idea of what a void was. And then I kind of researched, tried to find references to it. And I've only found references to it in ancient Buddhist texts. And those were only like very sparse, very hard to find even on the internet with all the information. There's only very few references. And like I said, as far as I know to this time, it doesn't exist as an English word. But as far as the void is philosophy to me is that it's based on this idea that what we know and our conception of ourselves is kind of like a bubble of light. And what we can see through our own self as a lens or through gazing into other forms of knowledge and stuff, everything that we are has a little bit of a limit. And everything around that limit is a void. And this is the philosophy side. There's a void around everything that we know, everything that we are. And the task of a voidist very basically is to delve into that void of what we don't know, reach out by learning, sharing information, talking to one another, but learning, gathering knowledge, practicing, and extending that void of what we are, what we understand, and what we know, extending ourselves out into that void around what we are and become bigger and bigger and bigger in the sense of a bigger grasp of ourselves, because ourselves is not necessarily at the center in this my voidist concept. Is as we kind of evolve and grow as a person, we're discovering what is at the center by learning what is without and kind of going, and as we try to figure things out, that's the same thing as expanding out into the void. And then we gain a grander concept of ourselves, then we are growing and we're ascending and we're kind of expanding into the void around what we don't know. And that involves practice, that involves learning, that involves sharing ideas. And in my book, I talk about claiming, you know, following your various virtues, identifying your virtues, and using those virtues to kind of pierce into the void. Now, virtue can be anything that you want for an individual. It doesn't have to be, you know, a stereotypical idea of virtues. But patience like that, expanding your patience, your practice of patience, allowing that to expand yourself into the void, or strength or courage or what have you. It can be a very basic concept like that. Expanding yourself into the void by your expansion of practice and what you learn from practices that give you more, that expand your ability to be patient or strong or knowledgeable or insightful, things like that. That's very basic voidist philosophy in my understanding and my kind of development of it.
Okay. All right. So there's no dogma, but I want to ask the concept of self. What is the concept of self in voidism? Is it that you are an awake being that's living a sort of a dream, or are you sort of like a being that comes from something more intelligent, you know, like how in the West we have like that idea of what quote unquote God, we come from something greater than ourselves, or what would it be in this philosophy?
In my idea of voidism, I didn't want to describe an idea of the self or where the self starts, because we discover ourselves as we expand. So I didn't want to create in Greek philosophy, there's this idea of a gem, and the many sided, every side of a gem is a different virtue. But the gem is the same gem. So I didn't want to describe a particular description or concept of the self for people, just the idea of expansion into the void. Now, as we expand, our concept of the self might change. So there's no core at the center idea of the self. There's no ascription to it. There's no qualities assigned to it. It is something that you discover over time, and it is something that you have to set, that you have to decide for yourself. At its heart, it's a very, very basic philosophy, and it doesn't. It's almost like it's a philosophy that you create your own heart of. You create your own center of. It is not a philosophy that ascribes a core or a central value for you. It is a process of discovering that for yourself, and you creating those, your own descriptions to it, and your own descriptions of yourself. And through your practices and through the idea of expansion. But that the expansion involves sharing, gathering knowledge, and practice. Once you find your practice, once you find your virtues that you want to expand. Once again, virtues, when we think of virtue, we think of like religion and dogma and stuff like that. But your virtue can be self-empowerment. That could be one of your virtues. And how do you pursue that practice? So it's at its core, there is no self-described, there is no description of what the self is. That's something that you have to find. Voidism is the process of finding that, not necessarily ascribing what it is.
Okay. That makes total sense, though. So it's really all about practicing, all about seeing, and all about discovering. Like, there is no
expansion. Yes.
Right. Okay. So it's not, it's nothing like, look, I mean, some people may have a problem with it in a sense, because a lot of people are used to someone telling them to look at the moon, you know, like, look at this wonderful finger pointing at that glowing sphere right ahead of you. And they're busy looking at the hand, the finger pointing, checking out the sleeves to see what kind of silk it's made out of. You know, all these little details we get caught up
in. It's all the Buddhist concept of I can only point at the finger that's pointing at the moon, that's pointing at the sun. I think, is that how it goes?
Something like that. Yeah. Yeah. It just gets really, you know, there's a lot of convoluted, like, kind of koans in Buddhism like that. Mm. You know, I think one of my favorite ones is the story that the Buddha says about suffering. And he gives the illustration with the arrow, you know, being, and some people would get caught up wondering, like, you know, like, who shot the arrow? What caste were they from? You know, when it's really just a poison arrow, get it out of me, you know, then we can worry about all that stuff later.
And that's the funny thing. I've always had a problem with, and this is why my path is so, my path is eclectic, but I don't call myself eclectic, because a lot of people do that. And it's more like a catchphrase now, and I don't like that. A lot of different pieces. There's a lot of different pieces that I gather. And it's almost, Buddhism is a little bit scary because it doesn't give you a concept of the self at all. It's almost like there's a void at the core, and then you're around that core. And then as you expand, that inner core, that whatever you discover the self is slowly illuminated. So the reason why I shy away from religion and combine different spiritual systems is because I don't like anything telling me what the self is, what is at my core, what is at the core of who I am. And I think that it's something that can't be ascribed or can't be told you. I think that's something that you have to discover. So it's a process of discovering, but with not very basic layout that anybody can honestly use. It's like a liberal form of philosophy and spirituality in a way, to where it gives you no internal framework. It allows you to find that internal framework. And then, of course, in the book that I wrote, I talk about the ways that I have thought and that I've expanded, and just looking at how I think, what I think, and seeing what I don't know. And then once I find what I truly don't know, I expand into that void, and my self-expansion becomes bigger, and then I am more. So it's a system of expansion, but not a system of self-description.
Can you give me an example of discovering something that you don't know that helps, that makes you expand a little bit more, like a quality or something that you've discovered?
Yeah. So a big part of it is discovering where we lie to ourselves. So if I can give you a very basic analogy, if you think that you know how to fight pretty well, and then you get into a street fight and you're getting hit with a lot of different hits that you had no idea existed, or you didn't realize somebody could get this good at hitting in this way. And then you get your ass beat. Then you decide, okay, how did that person fight? And how can I become better at, you know, fighting in that way? Because that's the way that beat me. In a way, it's very similar with ideas. If there's a hitch in your concept of God, of the source, of magic, if somebody presents an argument and you can't answer the question, or it kind of undermines everything that you believe, you need to learn about what just defeated you. And by learning about what just defeated you, you find your own weaknesses and you expand into those voids where there is cracks in your own self-expansion, in that bubble that you're expanding, that bubble of light that you're expanding. If it can be rays and not just a solid expansion of light, you need to plug those holes in a way, because that's where you have been beaten. So whether it's philosophy, spirituality, or magic, or even fighting, plug those holes by seeing where something got in, where something assaulted you and was successful, whether it be an idea or even physically.
Okay. All right.
That's one way to expand. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes total sense to me. It definitely does. Yeah, so it seems like voidism is a practice or non-practice of seeing, you know, like constantly looking, constantly seeing. And it's not like there's a path to follow because you're basically
it's almost like you're seeing where you are flawed and you're filling that space so that your expansion can continue. And that can be applied to many different areas of life.
I was going to say, in my distorted view of it so far, it's almost like starting at the source already instead of starting at an idea and hoping to like hop on an idea that takes us to the source. Like you're already starting at the source. You're starting at the very center already.
You're the filter through which you see the world and conceive everything is where you have to start. You have to start in your filter without knowing. It's almost like when you're in meditation and you're meditating and your consciousness is in a void and you try to look at yourself, but no matter where you look, that is you.
Right.
So you can't turn back and look at yourself. Very similar in voidism, my concept of it, to where you have to. It's almost like you have to find what you are by seeking. And it is almost starting at the source, but it's starting with your filters and seeing how your filters of how you conceive and how you practice are flawed and then correcting those flaws so that your focus and your understanding, your expansion can be more 360 rather than one direction at a time. And then slowly, as you conceive of everything around you, you can conceive of yourself. But this is both in ideas, not necessarily just looking at the world, but also in ideas and how you think. So it's narrowing it down to, but it is actually, I think that you're right in the sense that the source idea is very, very true. But there's no ascriptions to that source in a way. Does that make sense?
Okay. It makes sense. It was just, again, this is just like my interpretation in the 15 minutes we've been talking about this, because like I've been listening to you the whole time and kind of going like my filter is like, oh, so we're starting with the self. We're starting with the source already. And then like, if there's like a flaw or something that can, you know, because nature is always refining itself. Things are always like we were talking and I said something about entropy and how like pressure and entropy and challenges are just like a way of that, you know, makes things grow. So I was like, you know, when you were explaining voidism, I was like, okay, well, so we're starting at the source already. We're starting at the seer. And then kind of going out and expanding by being the seer and looking at the, I don't want to say lesser parts of herself, the more imperfect parts of herself, and kind of making those things into diamonds, if you will. And then, that's my way of looking at it. But
no, that's very good. And I think that's accurate. And I think that a lot of our blind spots is thinking that the way in which we look is correct. So the way we perceive and the way we think. So getting down to, so the way I started thinking about philosophy, or even started, this is, you know, early teens, late, I don't know, like tweens in the early teens. I started asking, you know, why did I draw this conclusion? Why did I come to this conclusion? Why is this my idea of love? Why do I like this group but not like that group? And I started out with the basic, you know, framework of natural preferences like everybody else. But then I just kept on asking, why am I coming to that conclusion? Why am I thinking this? And then I started to have a better idea of myself because I started to see the flaws in that. I wasn't observing and understanding how I thought or why I was thinking the roots of thoughts, why I was thinking things, why I was perceiving things in this or that way. It's very, I guess you could say it's very Buddhist in a way, because you're analyzing, because the first thing you have to do is analyze your thoughts, why you're coming to conclusions, why you're thinking something is this or that.
Fantastic. All right. So you were telling me before about your upbringing and about your earliest sense of self-concept and how you didn't really have like a personality. So what was that like? Like, was that really challenging? Because it seems like by age five, I'm not a psychologist. I'm going to throw that out there. I'm not, but I've done a lot of reading and research on my own about it. And from what I've read, from my understandings, by 5 years old, most of us have a solidified sense of self and an ego already. So you didn't really, right? Was yours more in the questioning phase, or what was that like?
I didn't for a long time. So like I said before, and I've talked about this a little bit, but I think that we were talking about some details that I haven't mentioned before. So like I said, I'm schizophrenic. So it took me a long time to form a personality. I didn't know how to do it. So all I could really do, so it was almost like I just observed. I was just really good I couldn't develop the filters that other people had. Like I couldn't develop like things between me and just seeing something and thinking about it. Like I would just see it and thinking about it. So for instance, if I started thinking about, I'll bring up a very specific thing that I remember from when I was like, this is before the age of 8. I don't remember how old I was. How old are people in kindergarten and first grade? Kindergarten's like what, 7?
They're younger. They're about 5 and 6 in kindergarten.
Kindergarten. Like I might have been about 7, but I remember being at the lunch table when I was like very small, obviously, because I the memory is pretty clear, but I was just much smaller. So I remember like looking up, but I was at the lunch table, and this one kid, for some reason, the discussion turned to, you know, he believed in Santa Claus, but not God. And then I asked, wait, but like, how do you believe in Santa Claus, but not God? And then somebody else, another kid was like, yeah, don't you know God created you? And then in my head, I'm like, that's not the question I was asking. In my head, I was working it out. I was like, okay, his parents don't believe in God. That's why he doesn't believe in God. They're atheists. I mean, I didn't know the word atheist, but I was working out in my head. And then I was like, oh, but Santa Claus, but we believe in Santa Claus, so he believes in Santa Claus. And then I was like, in my head, I'm like, does Santa Claus exist? Because in my head, I was like, okay, so God, in a way, to like these other kids, not me, because I wasn't raised with anything. I was like, okay, God in these other kids' heads, it seems like they're just copying their parents, is what I was thinking. And then I was like, oh, and then I didn't reach the next step of Santa Claus not being actually real, but I got really close. And I was like 7, but I was probably like seven. And I got really close, but I was just like, wait a minute, doesn't God and Santa Claus have very similar qualities? Because it seems like I didn't use the word belief in my head, but I was working it out. But so when it came time for me to like, or when I really started having questions about what every other kid was talking about, like what is this God thing? I was like, what is this? And I was kind of worked out in my head, like, okay, they think God created everything, okay. And then I remember looking up at my parents and being very small. And then I remember thinking in my head, like, should I ask them? And because this was later on when I was at home. And I was like, and I remembered all the experience of just watching them, like, argue. Like they argued as much as anybody else's parents. It wasn't, like, an abusive household or anything. But I remember watching them argue and respond to each other's emotions. And just thinking, like, why don't they just sit down and think together rather than responding based? I didn't use the word emotion, but I used my little kid understanding of emotion to think, like, why don't they just cut off the emotion, just sit down and like talk? I was like, if they can't even reach each other and they don't understand why they're responding with the way they're responding or responding with emotion, why would they know anything about this thing that's God? Like, why would they even know that? And then I was like, I made a decision in my head. I was like, okay, let me just go on. I know how to use a computer and internet. Let me just go and like look up some basic definitions, because just watching people not understand each other and not being able to communicate without a reaction based on what somebody else said and being hurt based on that, or not being able to look past that and looking to defeat somebody in an argument rather than work something out based on that, I started trusting what people told me less, because I realized that they didn't really understand themselves or why they responded the way that they did. So when the question came in my head, I'm like, they don't know anything about God, so I'm just going to go and figure it out for myself. And
that's interesting. So religion already had kind of like a, kind of a folly from the very beginning with you.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead.
Yeah. No, yeah. It, only a folly because I observed people were copying what their parents believed. And I realized that they were only doing it because of that. And I started to realize that other people were copying people. Other kids were copying personality traits from each other and their parents. I'm like, oh, that kid's dad does that. That's why he's doing what. That's why he.
You knew that as a little kid? You saw that? That's interesting. Wow.
I did. Because, well, I had a little bit of an advantage and disadvantage. So the advantage was that I could just like see things without having the filter, but like not being able to form a filter, your whole personality is a filter. And I just couldn't, I didn't know how to make a personality or like do that. And honestly, it took a long time. I was very like sensitive and very retractive and subdued and introverted for many, many years. But it did give me the advantage of just being able to like just watch people without like having a preconceived notions of why somebody did something based on whatever qualities they were displaying. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I have another question about that though. So this is probably a rhetorical question, but the children treat you much different because of that? Like, did they call you like any names, or were they just like, what's wrong with you? Like, why are you acting like this or anything like that ever happened?
I knew how to play along in the sense that I knew kind of how to kind of act like everybody else, but it wasn't me. I could copy other personality traits, but I never adopted them as my own. And that kind of formed my ability to be able to cloak myself for a long time, very long time, because I was just like, okay, I'll just use that personality trait, but I don't feel like it's me. But I was very conscious of forming my personality and how I responded to things. It took longer for me to be even able to like copy people's personalities, but eventually I could do it for long enough before I formed my own. And but I actually wasn't bullied any more than anybody else until like middle school. But that's when I moved. I knew how to play along, but I was so conscious of personality traits and why people why people did things, or just observing why people did things, that even if I played along with personality traits of others and like kind of like use this one or that one in order to communicate, I never adopted it until I was able to form my own personality and figure out who the hell I was. But it does sound in a lot of those instances, I don't know why I could just like play along, but didn't feel like I was that personality. But a lot of instances, people would be bullied that didn't have communication skills. I could fake it well enough to look normal and seem normal, but in myself, I knew that whatever I was using was not me, and I was still trying to figure out who the hell I was.
Okay, so you were aware of wearing the mask, wearing the persona.
Yes.
You were aware that it was a mask from the very beginning.
Yes, because I couldn't figure out how to form my own personality, but I knew how to copy little things. But they never felt like me. And it took me a long time to figure out what me was. And maybe most people don't, maybe people aren't aware of that process. And most people, they don't realize that they're just a big patchwork of copying. Ultimately, maybe everybody is, but I think that most people aren't aware of it. And the process was very confusing for me because I couldn't figure out who I was or what I was, but I could play along. Now thinking, I'm like, was everybody playing along and they just didn't realize? Did anybody really understand the process? Did anybody ever realize themselves, or did they just become patchworks that are hollow? So that's very much possibility for most people, it seems like. I mean, even looking at most people now, it's like, oh, well, I have a very similar process. I just have a central point that is me now that gives me a little bit more of an advantage, and that I know where I'm coming from rather than just playing along with everybody else.
I'm laughing because you're making me think of my friend Randy, who calls it the theater. He calls society and the 3D reality, I guess, the theater, and everybody is basically just playing along, but not knowing that they're playing along with it. But every once in a while, someone will figure out that it's all a show, it's all fake, and then, you know, they kind of.
You had me at Randy, and then now I even like Randy even more hearing the rest of that.
Oh yeah, yeah. He's a fun guy. I've known him for, God, I guess like over 4 years now, I call him the bicycle Buddha because he's really into cycling and like, he had fixed my bicycle and put new parts on it and talk about awareness for an hour or two. Like that's our relationship basically.
I feel like there's a Taoist metaphor of how the bicycle is the motion and all the parts are the patchwork cloak. The cloak is the parts and the motion is what the bicycle is.
I've been trying to get him to come on a podcast for a long time, but he's just not interested in coming on here. He just likes to talk to, because he's not really a big people guy. Like he had talked to me and his wife and like two other people, and like that's it. He's just not interested in talking to very many people.
because he
just stands out. And like I'll tell you a quick story. I know we're kind of like detracting a little bit, but like he went to his wife's father, or his father-in-law had passed away maybe like a few months ago. And he traveled to like SoCal to see the family and everything. And they're like kind of dividing up and trying to figure out like where the money's going to go and where all, you know, like that kind of post burial kind of things happen. And he went outside to get some fresh air by himself. And then someone comes outside and they're like, oh, so what's your story? Tell me about yourself. And he just kind of like looks at the guy, turns around, just walks the other way. He doesn't say anything. And the guy's like, well, that's rude, you know? And then the guy told Randy's wife, and she's like, he's like a cat. Is it where, like if you can understand how a cat acts, that's how he acts.
That's pretty great.
And it's true, because he's just not interested in like Mary. He doesn't like talking to very many people. He's just like, I don't want to sit here and like, you know, talk about my persona to this guy. He knows it's all bullshit, but he just does what he wants to do with his life. And that's
when you mentioned him being a cat and like his personality, I pictured a bunch of like little funny videos of where like a cat will be sitting on a couch and then like a little kid will come up to it. And then the cat just like looks at the parent like so annoyed.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Annoyed.
Like, what is this shit? What? Get away from me, little kid.
he has a cat. I remember the first time I went to his house, he has this cat. And I'm like, oh, what a cute cat. It's a little calico cat. And I go, what's her name? He goes, cat. It doesn't have a name.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. It's like our cat. He's like, we've never given our cat a name. It's just, you know, just comes whenever it wants to come and goes whenever it wants to go, and that's about it. It's like, okay. Anyway, I don't know. Like, I like bringing up those kinds of stories because there are people who are very aware of awareness and they're very aware of their sense of self. So now I want to kind of get into a little bit of magic territory. We still have some time in this segment here. So where does the sense of persona or the sense of self come in with the idea of the magus, meaning like, because when I think of what a magician is, I like the word magus. It sounds really cool, you know.
Very impressive.
It's a very impressive word, yeah. But the El Mágico has the ability of creating something. You know, they can pull something out of the void, or they can create. Like I would say that a magus or a magician is a degree. Has some sense of enlightenment because it's all about creativity. You know, it's an art to it. So you're creating something with using your will to, you know, manifest something that you want. I would think that most people would agree to it. Now, the different stages of magical play, the different schools of magic, techniques, etc., that's where everything sort of diverge from one another a little bit. You know, I know like you and myself also, we're more interested in kind of condensing all those things, and we don't give a fuck about like what school this is or, you know, where, yeah, I mean, we respect where it comes from and all, but just using what works, you know, at whatever stage we're at. But what does that mean to you? Like what point, I guess what I'm asking, what point in your life did you discover that, oh, you know, I can kind of like mold this. I can mold this to be more of what I want and then use it as something. Like, when did that sort of happen to you?
So starting off, I think that I view everything as not necessarily, so for us, it seems like creation. I think that I repurpose things. That very much ties into me working with spirits and the dead. For instance, the death energy that's produced or that I repurpose is kind of granted to me by the spirits because I'm making the transition of everything that they are easier, and I'm respecting them and I'm recognizing them. And then there's what is left from the exchange is this death energy, but it's repurposing of what was already there. It's a release of what was already there. So in a way, I think that all magic is a repurposing. In very recent years, I've gone away from the idea of creation. I feel like everything is a constant continuum, and everything that we do in magic is repurposing. So if we're talking about, are we talking about like void magic, just like just in general? Okay, yeah. So when I work with the dead, I view myself as reaching into that void. So what is like the void as an actual like energy or an actual like plane between planes or thing around things, if you were. So I view it as a dense and like folding darkness, but it's not darkness in a sense of not being light as much as it is a folding of potentiality that exists around everything that seems linear and that seems separate. It's almost like the condensation of everything that could be around what is. And there's a reason why it exists around all planes of existence, because it is both the membrane and the barrier between different phases and realities and different universes. It's only the barrier because I feel like it's more like a fluidic space. We think of the void as like an emptiness, but it's not quite emptiness. It's almost like folded darkness. It has a density to it. And that density is both potential, and that density is both conscious. It is consciousness in its most subconscious way, where it has both vast potential, but it is not self-aware. It is conscious, but it is not aware that it is conscious. And because everything is ultimately consciousness, it could be said that there's more space, or ultimately everything's one thing in my idea, but there's more space in the planes or in the universes than there are in the void. Because everything that is drawn in from the little abyss. And the little abyss, or the ordered abyss, is the void. Because the abyss is something a bit different, but it's similar in a way. Because you can reach out into the void, and if you know how to grab things, there's nothing there. But the act of grabbing and your conception of what you're grabbing can produce something in your reality. So if you know how to grab, and there's various specific practices that I can go into, but perhaps that's for a different podcast. But there is it. What are we at as far as like time goes? Are we?
We're pretty good. Yeah, go ahead. You can go ahead and finish your point.
Okay. Yeah. It's differentiation exists not in the void. The void is undifferentiated. Differentiation and ultimately the illusion of separation exists in the bubbles that the void surrounds. I guess you can think of the cell body, like the fluid in a cell that's around. I might be exposing my lack of knowledge of biology, but what's around everything that's in a single blood cell, like the mitochondria, and like the nucleus and things like that, all the fluid around that is kind of the void that allows for
the cell body, basically.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Gotcha.
Around everything that exists in the cell, and every little thing inside of a cell is very ordered and has a function. Mm-hmm. The void in and of itself, it doesn't have a function in and of itself. It just is. It's almost undesigned. It's the undesigned form around everything else.
Okay, let me ask you this question real quick here. So is it something tangible, or is it something like a quantum superposition, which people who know about, any of you physics freaks out there, you know that a particle that hasn't gone in any particular direction. It's about to be charged. It has a potential of doing of charge. It has a potential of going to other different places, basically. You know what I mean? So, and that's kind of how that's for me. That's how I see it. I don't see it as like a. I'm not trying to inject my view on it, but I don't see the void as an actual realm or a place like we do in movies where the character might fall through like a little hole and end up in this like vast blackness and like, where are you?
The void.
I'm in the void.
That hole that character falls through, that little rim that creates that's in the hole, that's the void. So physical as far as like, it's both an idea and it can't, and it also exists on a quantum level. But if we're talking about connecting with that energy, just like if we could find a way to get to other dimensions, like just not necessarily astral project, but use our physical bodies by using even machines or something like that, we'd have to pierce the void. And it's not, if it is its own plane around planes, it doesn't exist with the same kind of spatial concept that we understand space as. It's almost like trying to conceive of a fourth or fifth dimension where, you know, there's a three-dimensional cube on every side of a cube. We can't conceive of it because it's not part of our reality, but that's kind of what the void is. It's not a section of space that you can just like fly into.
Okay.
I haven't considered the quantum aspect, but I imagine that it does have some relativity to that as well.
Okay. All right. So let's talk about spirits for a moment. So like, what is the interplay between spirits and a void?
So my understanding of, I've talked a lot about soul fragmentation, a lot of my videos, just very briefly, you know, when somebody dies, there's many different sections that we kind of like split into. So something that you consider as a ghost that we can kind of like see around, that's the ego not wanting to let go and being attached to this, to the dimension that they're in or their universe that they're in. The spirit itself is a life force that is borrowed from the planet and that wants to go back into the planet. And the soul cannot be confined. It's the true antimaterial particle, which this is kind of the reason we age, because it wants to shake free and go back to the source. So the soul can't be confined. Souls don't stick around. It's the ego that can form ghosts and things like that. So if we're talking about spirits, I use that in reference to everything but the soul, kind of. So when a spirit is not at rest, it could mean usually both. There's some part of the personality that's still attached to the life force that's not allowing the life force to go back into the earth because it's still attached to its space-time understanding or its identification with the body. It's not going back into the earth. That's a problem. That's something that I try to allow to usher on and to move back into. Ghosts or the ego that stick around, that's also, I often describe them as spirits as well, and it's a little bit different kind of spirit, but that needs to be ushered on as well. So in relation to the void, it's almost like ghosts and spirits, you know, the ego having attachment of both the life force attached to the body and who it was as well. Both of those things in a way need to go back into their own kind of void. So the spirit, the life force, in my understanding, in my practice, that needs to go back into the earth, it's going into its own kind of void. There's many different kinds of voids, but the void that exists, there's a little void around this in this planet, in a way. It's not necessarily in as far as space goes, but it's kind of like in the combined spirit of the planet, the combined life force of the planet. It needs to go back into that void, that potentiality to be any life force on this planet. It needs to go back in so that it can be repurposed by nature and by souls trying to come back into this earth and this dimension. And in order for it to be repurposed, it has to move on. That's something that I try to help out with successfully in my understanding. But sometimes the life force, it's very stubborn, just like the ego can be very stubborn. So when the life force is associated with the body, it's more of a clinging away from the void that it needs to go back in, that's in the earth. When a ghost form of spirit sticks around, it's something that kind of needs to dissipate into a different kind of void, a void of consciousness. It's almost like it needs to diffuse into the void that we've been talking about, where there's this void of consciousness that's like the supreme subconscious that is around this planet, but also around this universe. In order for that consciousness to be repurposed and to either be magnified or exist in another being, that ghost needs to let go of who it was and allow that consciousness to fall back into everything. And the void that is that void we were talking about, that's the consciousness that's kind of around everything, but not aware of itself, but conscious, but not aware of itself. Very strange. It kind of goes back to a description of hell in for the Nordic people. And, you know, hell is a multi kind of layered thing. It's not hell in the Christian sense, as I'm sure a lot of people watching this know. It's the ghosts that go to hell, per se, it's not necessarily a place where you suffer or anything like that. It's a place where you rest and slowly dissipate back into the grander consciousness. That is this void consciousness that kind of exists around everything. It also, it can harken back to also the, so a lot of people believe that there was an Aztec goddess that I'm not going to butcher the name of by mentioning the name, but she became Santa Muerte. She used to be a goddess of death for the Aztecs. And for the Aztecs, there's a description of a womb. And before you were reborn, you'd go into that womb of this death goddess to rest and to kind of reform, but to rest. I think it's described as cold, but peaceful. And then you rest until your consciousness is kind of repurposed. And they didn't use the word consciousness, but as a transliteration or a similar concept. But that did pop up in both Norse and Aztec understanding of mythology. But that part of us that goes into that, or goes into that hell, H-E-L space, or that mother goddess womb, as it's described, that's a little bit different from the life force that goes into the life force of the void. It's kind of like a more light and life oriented void that exists in the earth. And then the void that our consciousness needs to kind of seep back into, to the grander subconscious, that is that's a different part of us, and it's not necessarily life. It's a little bit different vibration than that. But does that all make sense in some regard?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, thanks for that. It makes total sense. Yeah, so I'm kind of getting I don't know, man. I have a lot of weird, strange ways of interpreting things, depending on where I'm at in my life, even though I'm not a computer programmer. So are you saying like a ghost or a spirit is sort of like a code like that that's generated within the void, something like kind of like that, and it has its own little void with it?
Yeah, I guess it's very apt. I think that there's a base code. I guess if we're going to use numerology, it'd be like the idea of zero and, you know, thanks Hinduism for giving zero to the West. But
exactly. Yeah. Thank you. But, Shunyata. Yeah.
Yeah. Shunya. It's the base code that underlies everything. It is the canvas that is unrecognized, that if we're aware of, we can paint our reality as a magician. If we're working with spirits, your necromancer, I never really settled on exactly what my practice is. I just say I work with the dead. the best term would be necromancer, but a lot of people have different connotations with that. That kind of not exactly what I do, because some people.
It certainly sounds cool,
right?
Yeah.
Because there's a way to take advantage of those pieces, and so I'm more of a person who allows them to help them move on or move those sections. Of themselves move on, whereas some necromancers will try to reappropriate the personalities of people and get that life force or get that consciousness to cling to the idea of self and then repurpose that as a servant and give it, feed it self-identification, self-reinforcement, so that those pieces of energy don't move on. A lot of necromancers do that. They repurpose and enslave those sections rather than allowing them to move on. There's a whole spectrum of what you can consider as a necromancer. And I guess chaos magic or blood magic, it does have a relationship to the void as well. I think that when I'm doing blood magic, it's repurposing my own life force. I'm repurposing my own life force to affect change in my reality. Very effective if you know how to do it. It takes a lot of practice, and most of my experience is from practice. I've learned bits and pieces, but I've learned over time in practice. When it comes to chaos magic, that is more using that, tapping into that base code of the grander subconscious and drawing from that, but not necessarily reinforcing the self-identity of a spirit, but drawing from that grander subconscious. It's almost like chaos magic is you're birthing an action rather than nature birthing a consciousness and a life form. You're birthing that action by a direction of your own energy in combination with the grander subconscious that the ghost or the consciousness would dissolve into usually. And then it's the difference between enslaving what is then, or just birthing something yourself, is what chaos magic is to me. And that's how I use it. Blood magic is using my own life, my own spirit that I got from the earth and using that to enact change. So I think that's the difference between blood magic and chaos magic for me. And that's kind of its relationship to the different voids and I suppose necromancy as well.
Nice. Man, I mean, I'm really glad that you brought that up, that you described it, because, excuse me, most of us that practice chaos magic or some form of magic of some sort has a different perspective or a different explanation of what chaos magic is. To some people, it's more of like LOA. To some others, they might have like lots and lots of spirit type of magic involved. Some others, it's like egregores, servitors, and things like that.
See, egregores and servitors, I've created a number of servitors, and it is birthing something from that grander subconscious. And right. Our subconscious is connected to that. And if we can delve into that, both with, you know, that's why servitors and sigils work very well together, is because with sigils, we're delving into our subconscious connected to the grander subconscious when it works. If you are able to make that connection and that initiation of that birth of an action or birth of a being that exists for a singular purpose. But it is, once again, not repurposing something that already exists. It is a birthing in and of itself.
Yeah. Wonderful. All right. Awesome. Well, I guess like I want to kind of finish up by asking one more question of yours is, since you do work with like death magic and whatnot, necromancy, I guess. So is there a such thing as death, meaning like a finishing? Most of us in the West, we have this idea that death is very negative. You know, it's a very sad thing. I feel like ever since I've lost my mother, you know, like 6 years ago, I've been rewiring myself to see death very differently. You know, I had an experience after my mom had passed of interacting with her on a couple of occasions since then. You know, which has given me a very different perspective of what death is. So is death something like, I guess, what is it to you? What is death exactly to you, in your view?
So I think death doesn't exist, but it's the truest way that somebody can create death is an unnatural continuation of something that needs to move on. I think that is the side of necromancy that I don't like and wouldn't delve into, is unnatural continuation. So we're talking the idea of liches, the idea of unnatural forced vampiric continuation. So there's a lot of nuance and fill in the gaps when we think about what a lich is. So we have this idea of what liches are, whether it be in Skyrim or in fantasy. I do believe liches exist, but they're very extremely rare, and they wouldn't look different than us. So what a lich is. So I guess in a way, liches create a temporary death, whereas death doesn't exist naturally. Ultimately, death just doesn't exist naturally. Everything becomes something else. So what a lich does, basically, and there's a lot of nuance, and there's a lot of practices and little historical things dating back a long time that would describe how a lich does this. But very basically, what a lich does, separates the soul from their body in a container, but not necessarily like a physical container. But separating the soul from their body, it can be done in an energetic way. It doesn't have to be like a vase, like in fantasy or something like that. But it's a separation from the soul from the body, so that the ego and the life force is not solely torn down by the soul, because the soul makes us age because it's trying to get back to the source, and it keeps on going from life to life to life. So if you can just become ego and remove the soul from yourself, once again, not theatrically, in a more energetic way where it's an unseen by the eye kind of way, and it's very, very, very difficult to do. I mean, maybe one in 10 million people might be able to do it if they practice multiple lifetimes of magic trying to accomplish this. Then you would not age in the usual sense, and you could remain your person, yourself, your ego, for an indeterminate amount of time, because I don't know about the limitations beyond that. But that's, I would say that somebody who's a lich creates death in the truest way it can exist, because otherwise I don't think death truly exists. Liches are, in a sense, create something that would be considered as the usual idea of death, because death to me isn't an ending. It's something that doesn't naturally exist. So, in a way, temporarily containing, because I don't think any lich is immortal. We're using a lot of pop culture here that gets very convoluted. But
that's all right. People appreciate it on here. So
there's a temporary creation of death. When a self decides to exist beyond its use to the soul.
Nice. Wonderful. Well, hey, man, I am excited to upload this. And right now, in the future, it's already uploaded and being listened to right now. So, but I want to thank you for coming on again, man. It's always a pleasure having you on here. We have collaborate again in the future, I'm sure. This is fantastic. I've been wanting to do an episode about these subjects for a while. I just haven't asked you about it and talked to you much about it, but it's been brewing for a while. So yeah, I appreciate this. Thanks for explaining what this is, voidism. So if you haven't checked out Hunter's channel on YouTube, check it out. It's named after himself, Hunter Zalazar, which is pretty easy to find. Just look up his name. Yeah. He's got a ton of videos, great content. He has content about, man, all kinds of stuff like necromancy or death work, blood magic, vampire stuff, Hindu related topics, all kinds of stuff, man. So check his channel out.
Odin rituals, Kali Ma, different gods.
Yeah, so many rituals. Yeah, it's pretty cool. So yeah, check him out. And I want to thank everybody for supporting this podcast and bearing with me through my little mini hiatus. Excuse me. I will be uploading lots of content. I'm not going to take any long breaks for a while. At least I won't plan on it. Yeah. Anyway, I'll see everybody next time. And peace out, everyone.
Have a good one.